I'm Barb River Kylan, my husband Dale, and we're on an adventure. And we've been driving across country from Madison, Wisconsin, just like the monks of old, and they would visit different places and different teachers, and connecting with old friends and meeting new people. Now, one of the motivations for for doing that is that a couple of years ago we started a little Zen publishing house. And this morning I'd like to say thank you for the opportunity to introduce a book that we co-authored, Tending the Fire, An Introspective Guide to Zen Awakening. I will provide an introduction and a little background on the material, as well as offer definition of key terms within the study, and try to place the subject in relation to traditional Zen practice. The subject of tending the fire is focused on one aspect of dukkha, dukkha as conditioned states. The Buddha is purported to have said, "I teach only one thing. I teach dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. I teach the nature of suffering and cessation of suffering." It is also taught that dukkha is comprised of three elements: dukkha as ordinary pain, dukkha as impermanence, and dukkha as conditioned states. The first two are well described in Buddhist literature. The dukkha of ordinary pain encompasses anything that any of us would consider painful and understandably causes suffering. This includes birth, illness, physical disability, old age, death, any situation that causes stress or grief, and other forms of mental suffering. Dukkha as impermanence is the truth that everything changes. Impermanence is the nature of reality and also encompasses the nuance of insubstantiality and uncertainty. Dukkha as conditioned states, however, is not as easily understood. Dukkha as conditioned states is considered the subtlest form of dukkha. I'll just wait a few minutes for people to get in. Okay. I'd like to just go back to dukkha as impermanence for a moment. So if the nature of reality is impermanence, the Buddha once said anything that is impermanent is dukkha. So if the nature of reality is impermanence, and anything that is impermanent is dukkha, then we get to the first noble truth: life is dukkha. Life is suffering. But we don't enjoy individuals first encountering this teaching may prematurely decide that Buddhism is pessimistic. It's not pleasant to hear that life is suffering. But the Buddha didn't deny that there's happiness in life or pleasant circumstances. But because everything changes, when the conditions that support our agreeable circumstances wane, we tend to suffer. But the third aspect, dukkha as conditioned states, however, is not as easily understood. Conditioned states are considered the subtlest form of dukkha. Being born as a human being, or a being of any form for that matter, is itself a conditioned state. Within Buddhist philosophy, what we refer to as I or me is just an ever-changing combination of mental and physical energies made up of five aggregates: form, sensation, perception, activity, and consciousness. Nothing that does not change or isn't insubstantial. Many sources define conditioned states briefly as ego clinging or attachment to self. And I've always found that simplification unhelpful. And just recently I've begun to think that it actually is a disservice. It sets up ego as an enemy, and then we get trapped in dynamics of resisting and struggling with things within ourselves that we don't fully understand, and it can be a fruitless activity. Ego is a function of mind that develops in a human being beyond our will. And within this, and an inherent part of our makeup. When within this study, it's considered the source of our sense of self, and the holder of our personal narrative and continuity of experience. Ego also contributes to a fundamental misperception that's inherent to human experience that we call the natural koan. And this fundamental misperception is what leads us to experience ourselves as permanent, independent entities separate from the world. Although the natural koan is common to everyone, each person manifests the difficulty it represents idiosyncratically based on the circumstances of their life. The fundamental misperception is what hinders our understanding of the Buddhist teaching of anatta, or no-self nature. Buddhism teaches that in order for a being, thing, or phenomena to be considered to have a self, it must be permanent and unchanging. As there is nothing that is permanent and unchanging, the Buddha taught the doctrine of anatta. The Buddha's teaching of the doctrine of no permanent self nature is derived from his deep understanding of impermanence and the understanding of the interdependent co-arising of all phenomena. Now, philosophically, we may understand and accept this truth, but experientially, it's difficult to go beyond the notion of self. And, ironically, to experience no self nature, one needs a healthy sense of self. So is ego something that we should explore, investigate, understand, and have a mature relationship toward? Most definitely yes, but not in a self-hating, deprecating way. For this discussion, I'd like to refer to this sense of self we experience as the personal aspect of our nature. It exists, so is true, from a relative perspective. No permanent self-nature is the truth from the ultimate perception of reality and is the universal aspect of our nature. Ajahn Chah said, "You should know both the universal and the personal, the realm of forms and the freedom to not cling to them. The forms of the world have their place, but in another way, there's nothing there. To be free, we must respect both these truths." I think this statement is totally in line with Zen Master Dogen's radical non-duality, where no aspect of human experience is left out of wholeness. And wholeness is the medicinal necessary for ameliorating suffering. So the question is, how do we perceive the truth of the universal aspect of our nature, a requisite for the cessation of suffering, when the personal aspect of our nature, our sense of self, tends to hinder the intimacy required for the understanding of the universal? It is the contention of this study that working with dukkha as conditioned states can play a significant role in the reduction of the fundamental misperception. When we reflect on the three elements of dukkha, it's the most beneficial place to exert our energy. When the dukkha of ordinary pain arises, we don't have the choice of not experiencing it. We can and should respond skillfully, but when we get a toothache, even though we call our dentist, we still have the toothache, and we have to endure it until we don't have the toothache. Dukkha as impermanence is the nature of reality, and we can't change the nature of reality. Not that we don't try. And by that I mean, how much more suffering do we create when we are unable to accept how things have changed? And by accept, I don't mean a passive giving up either. But dukkha as conditioned states is where we can really work towards freeing ourselves. Conditioned states serve to reify ourselves in negative and detrimental ways. Working with our idiosyncratic conditioned states clears what obstructs our view of the universal aspect of our nature, about which the Buddha said is fundamentally pure. While I was working as a psychotherapist, I encountered the work of a man named David Grove, and it was primarily through the study of his work that I began to grasp the problem and the depth of the difficulty of dukkha as conditioned states. Grove provided a cogent framework for understanding the origin, operation, and possible resolution of conditioned states, although he never referred to them as such. Dale and I had been practicing Zen for 20 years before coming in contact with Grove's work. Our practice or our training was maintaining a consistent meditation practice, attending sesshin, listening to Dharma talks, reading a variety of Buddhist texts. Neither of us could imagine our life without it. But to be honest, as valuable as our practice had been, We still found ourselves confined by the same boundary of limitations that we had when we first encountered Zen. There were some changes, of course. We did manage to grow up a bit. But there were core issues, certain fears, anxieties, propensities, and insecurities that persisted. So we began to use Grove's methods with these identified limitations. Surprisingly, and I'm not sure why we were surprised, we found that we not only achieved greater personal freedom from the conditions we chose to work on, but with each resolution of an issue, our meditation practice deepened, as well as our understanding of basic Buddhist principles. That's a big introduction, and now we'll get to a definition of conditioned states. So within this study, conditioned states are seen as the limiting tendencies we struggle against within ourselves. Conditioned states are frustrating because no amount of intellectual understanding about why we are the way we are seems to lessen their impact. Conditioned states are further defined as deeply rooted psychophysical formations predicated by negative events. A conditioned state is how we store the negative learning of an unresolved experience, and it is held somewhere in the body as a symptom. A complex of afflictive emotions, thought patterns, and behaviors accompanies them. And these psychophysical formations and the symptoms they generate replicate themselves over and over when the conditioned state is triggered in subsequent life events. And because a conditioned state is the record of a negative experience, it has a negative charge. It's something we don't want to be experiencing. That's what we struggle against, that we're experiencing this negative. But in the end, a conditioned state is just a container of information. It's how that event is stored. It is important in working with a conditioned state to refrain from judging it or feeling shame for experiencing it, because just like our sense of self, it arises naturally by the nature of our design. And it's not wrong or bad. At the time that it originated, it just was the most appropriate response available to us. The problem with a conditioned state is that it continues to influence our thoughts, feelings, and responses to new situations that we tend to find very limiting and even debilitating. Regarding the limitations of a conditioned state, they are how we know we have what we have. I offer this example for clarification. Right now, I'm a bit nervous talking to you about this. How do I know I'm nervous? Well, there's a little fluttery feeling right here, as if sharing this information was something really risky. This is the geography of my public speaking nervousness. It is a conditioned state, is it? Yes, and I know this because I've worked on it over the years. And when it began, it occupied the space from my throat to my solar plexus, and it was much more than a little fluttery feeling. What's the origin of it? Well, probably the way fear of public speaking arises in any of us. By sharing, being embarrassed as a child for sharing some innocent belief, or being criticized in the past for something you said, or frequently getting the message, we should just be quiet. Don't you think it's interesting how many of us get really nervous at the thought of just speaking to a group of people? Why should that be so scary? Well, maybe it's deeper than the examples I've just listed. Maybe we carry it in our genes. In the scope of the history of human experience, how many people have been exiled, imprisoned, tortured, or killed for something they've said? On the scale of life stressors, fear of public speaking often rates higher than fear of death. Jerry Seinfeld said that this means that at a funeral, most of us would rather be the one in the coffin than the person giving the eulogy. And after going over what I wanted to present here, I found a book in the Fitchburg Library where we live by Lewis Richmond called Aging, a Spiritual Practice. I'm there. And in it, I came across, he referred to a Buddhist teaching that I hadn't come across in all the years that I've been reading Buddhist literature. And it was called, it's called the Five Great Fears. And they are fear of death, fear of illness, fear of losing one's mind, fear of loss of livelihood, and fear of public speaking. So it's ancient, and it's deep. But I digress. Back to conditioned states. Have you ever heard anyone say of their experience, "I don't know what happened to me. All of a sudden, I felt like I was 5 years old, and I had no idea how to deal with the situation." When that happens, rest assured, the person has succumbed to the spell of a conditioned state. Once I had a consultation with a gentleman who couldn't understand what happened to him every time he had a conversation with his boss, if it took place in the boss's office, if they met in the hall, or the boss came to his workstation, or at meetings in the conference room, he was fine. But when he was in the boss's office, he lost all his ability to problem solve. He said, "I just go blank." Eventually, he figured out that when he was conversing with his boss in his office, where he sat and how he looked at his boss directly replicated the angle or line of sight that he had with his authoritarian and abusive father at the family dinner table. So the next time he needed to meet with his boss in the office, he deliberately, of course, chose another chair with a different line of sight and retained his ability to be present in that experience. Well, that was a nice fix for that circumstance, but it doesn't alleviate the source of the problem, and that conditioned state will likely be triggered by other events in his life. To work with conditioned states, we have to recognize them for what they are. And that's not so easy because they most often operate outside our level of awareness. They just come up on us. And even when we begin to recognize the dynamics of a conditioned state or have a thorough understanding of why we react the way we do in certain situations, it's often not enough to alleviate the symptoms and allow us to respond differently in a circumstance. And that's why I said earlier that the simplification of dukkha as conditioned states as ego clinging is simplistic. We don't cling to it. I think we have an enormous struggle, and we try mightily to let go, and we have a most sincere willingness and interest in changing. It clings to us, and the it that clings is the psychophysical formation that constitutes the conditioned state. How do you identify a conditioned state? They're the tendencies that we find most limiting to living our life. As many of them arise in childhood, they've been present for most of our conscious life, and we tend to accept them as, "That's just the way I am." There are degrees of conditioned states. They result from a subjectively experienced negative event. It doesn't have to be something extreme, like a serious illness, accident, or natural disaster. It can be the look in a parent's eye or the tone of a teacher's comment. Not all negative experiences will result in a conditioned state. Conditioned states are differentiated from other types of learning that we might consider conditioning by the negative charge they exert. I'm conditioned in many ways that I don't mind, like my ability to drive a car. But if I get into a car accident, and then even if it's a minor accident, nobody's hurt, and every time I get into a car, I have a sense of panic about being in an accident, and if that doesn't pass in a reasonable amount of time, well, then I would be dealing with conditioned state. It takes some effort on our part to change the pattern of a conditioned state. And this study offers one way that effort can be applied, and Dale will be outlining the specifics of that shortly. A two-year course on this study was on this material was studied with the Madison Sangha, and that eventually led to the book. And all this developed out of an unusual circumstance. I like to think of it as a very Zen experience, actually. I had been rereading Ehei Dogen, Mystical Realist, by Heejin Kim. And on page 88, I came across a statement that had a profound effect on me. Two words, to be particular. And those two words were existential metabolism. And to me, those two words kind of summed up all the work that we had been doing in our study of conditioned states. We used the term existential to mean experiential, and metabolism to mean the process of. So understanding the process of an experience. At first, we called the method that developed from this study the existential metabolism of conditioned states. And later, we renamed it the existential metabolism of awakening. Because as practitioners, when we can resolve a conditioned state, it issues us into a new state of being. It alters, in a positive way, our relationship to our sense of self and thereby our relationship with the world. So all the years that we've been studying this coalesced with those two words. And one day, jokingly, I said to Dale, we need a symbol or something, you know, that can represent all of this. Why don't you create one for us? And he did. So tending the fire is the outcome of our experiential research of working directly with conditioned states for the past 20 years. It is a description of a process we developed that we call Zazen introspection and the resolution sequence. Working with it, one can use a conditioned state as a meditative practice. And what makes it meditative is our orientation toward the issue we want to work on. And the requirements for that are clarity of intention and non-judgmental attention, the very skills honed in Shikantaza. So we offer this study as a skillful means and adjunct to traditional Zen practice. And Dale will take it from here.
We have limited time, and so the best I can do is just to give the...
Go as long as you.
Okay. So these, what I'm handing out, first out, are the symbols, two of the iterations of the symbols that we've developed. We've got about 8 or 10 of them, different ones, and these two that are being handed out are the ones that we're going to be talking about generally here on it. Actually, I'm going to take, there's quite a bit of stuff on here, and you know, most symbols, they encapsulate a lot of information. You know, for example, if you can remember just a simple algebraic equation, you know, 4x minus 4x squared minus 3x plus 8 equals 0. All of the different relationships and understandings one needs to know in order to make that symbol meaningful to you. And so, what we have, you know, what you have here is, you know, quite a bit more than what I can communicate wholly in just a short period. It generally takes a day's seminar in order to give enough information on it. So, however, I'm going to pick out, you know, three different items off of the symbol. In Figure 1, you'll see on the sides of the triangle deconstruction and reconstruction, and we're going to use those. And also on Figure 1, there's some letters, different varieties of A's. You have little a and then big A, and big A, little a, and then two big A's. Those are what are we call the awakenings, the four awakenings. So we're going to go through those generally. And then on Figure 2 is added to Figure 1, essentially, is the introspective guide itself that we call this the resolution sequence. So I'll be referring it to either way. I think. Okay, so deconstruction. As Barbara has been talking about, she's been talking about conditioned states. So this whole book is based on trying to understand what conditioned states are and resolve them. And the deconstruction is the first act where we, you know, encounter the conditioned states and we work with it. And what we do with it is we examine the set of assumptions and the habitual thinking patterns that are on the basis of this conditioning on it. And then we go on from there. There are three things that you need to do in order to have an effective deconstruction. One is you have to know that there is a problem. Two is that you have to understand that conscious activity can be successfully employed in order to resolve that problem. And the third problem is you have to do it. Just recently we were visiting and we've met a couple of shirt-tail relatives, both of them, and both of them have got a great deal of affection for Barbara's, a couple of other of Barbara's books, and both of them really get the first two, but they said, both of them separately, they said, I don't want to do the work on it. So deconstruction is limited right away for them on it. The outcome of deconstruction is the resolution of the conditioned state. And I'll talk later about what that term means. What does it mean to resolve a conditioned state? Reconstruction takes the outcome of deconstruction and integrates it into our daily life. The outcome of deconstruction is freedom from the afflictive emotions and habitual patterns that are imposed on us by conditioned states. And so being free of that gives us the opportunity to take that freedom and make it our own. And this is the process of reconstruction. It's integrating that freedom into our life on it. It's learning to live that freedom. And it's its outcome. Once you fully integrate it, then you can move in the world with unencumbered activity. Before that, the conditioned states during deconstruction will cause some serious inhibitions and afflictive emotions. During the reconstructive phase, when you have the opportunity to integrate that, you still have habit energies that get in the way. They don't form as afflictive emotions, but they interfere and distract. So that, in brief, is deconstruction and reconstruction on it. The second thing we'd like to just introduce is the awakenings. Now, you know, these awakenings are something that we are all really familiar with already. These are the critical moments in our life where life-altering events occur and things become different. And, you know, at this time, you know, they will change our whole attitude and our outlook on different things. And we've identified, and we look at at our study as there are two different types of awakenings. The first one is what we call awakening of perspective. In other words, we recognize with the things that have happened in our life, there's a different view and a different intention and different motivational opportunity arise from something that we had experienced. Generally, perspective awakenings are gradual. They come on in bits and pieces, and then something coalesces and we change the way we go about our life. The second kind are transformational awakenings. And these are the ones that resolve conditioned states, resolve the psychophysical formations on which the conditioned state is based, and are the avenues to freedom. And generally, they are sudden events that occur and at some particular time. They didn't be as dramatic as you find always in particular books, but you know, nonetheless, they are dramatic if we look at them in the context of our own life. Now you can say there's four awakenings on there, and the first one is awakening little a. And it is a perspective awakening, you know, that witnesses the conditioned state or problem as it arises or unfolds. Prior to this awakening, the conditioned state just acted out Our life is on autopilot, and all of this stuff is shooting out of us and shooting into the world on different things. And you can, and I think all of us can, all of us, you know, will, you know, understand, you know, when we're, things are out of control in our life, when our relationships are poor, we have anger, we've got, we're holding on to grudges, we have excessive anxiety, confusion, you name it. It's all based on an unresolved and unidentified conditioned state on it. We can say that that with the awakening of little A, we relieve ourselves of the being unconsciously trapped by the conditioning and replace it with a conscious awareness of this. We start to live consciously with it. When we do this, we can become, we can then say what the conditioned state is. We can articulate it. And I studied with Katagiri Roshi for many years, and oftentimes I would go to Dokusan. I really had nothing to say to him, but he always had the same thing coming up. He would say, "What is your problem?" He wants to know, you know, what is the issue that you're dealing with right now. He wouldn't let me off the hook on things, and so it was his gentle way of doing it. But that was a very important thing to do. Now, this awakening, you know, is something, like I mentioned before, that is gradual, and it begins with a passive observation of the conditioned state as it arises and unfolds and manifests in our life. And then later it becomes more, we can embrace the conditioned state without fear, without doubt, without uncertainty of what's coming on. We can recognize how a conditioned state is contains not only the symptom, but the cure. It not only contains, you know, the delusion, but the enlightenment. It not only contains the pain, but the joy that can arise from it. And so the conditioned state at the beginning, this little A, is probably the most difficult thing that a Zen student will encounter in their whole Zen career. Finding that stability to deal and understand what a conditioned state is and creatively work with it. Awakening, big A, is a sudden breakthrough that where the barriers to the universal mind drop away. During awakening, the awakening, little A, we become, you know, become aware of the activity of the universal mind within us, and only in the transformation do the barriers to the free operation of that, you know, go on it. The awakening, big A, is a change of being, and in it, the conditioned states are resolved, and the psychophysical formation that is at its root jettisoned and removed. Now, this is essentially the two awakenings that are in deconstruction. The next two are during the reconstructive phase, where we're taking this freedom of experience. The Korean Zen master Chin Yul calls awakening A, this experience, the sacred embryo. And this is not a term that Dogen would like at all. But nonetheless, it gives the picture of something nascent and new and needing, you know, a lot of care for a long time. Wei Ning's teacher, Daiman Konan, you know, Wei Ning came to him, you know, and they had this relationship. Most of you are probably familiar with, you know, and he said, "Go out and, you know, hide yourself for 20 years." This is essentially what he was saying. You've got, you know, the nut of it, but now you've got to make it your own. You have to go out and live this and do this. And this is what he did on it. So awakening, big A, little A, contains the freedom that's from the deconstruction, but it also contains, you know, another perspective, a jolt, another way to look at the world. When we were studying in deconstruction, we were studying conditioned states, and here we are studying how freedom operates within us. Reconstruction is an exceedingly pleasant and powerful and something that you really want to do, because you can see the opportunity and you can see the accomplishment and the progress going on with this, on it. And this awakening, A, little A, brings us to this. It takes us to the central issue of reconstruction, where we embody this freedom. And like deconstruction, where the little A started and got bigger, this too starts small and gets bigger. Awakening, big A, big A. This is where the freedom aspects, the aspects of our free life that we first experienced as a small nascent freedom awakening A is completely integrated, and we have no barriers to acting in accord in the world. This is a place of where all of the troubles that we've had, the inhibitions, you know, are gone away, and we can act very naturally in accord with the needs of ourselves and with others. So briefly, you know, that is the awakenings on it. So on figure two, we have a little bit deeper, you know, understanding of what's going on during the deconstructive phase. We describe deconstruction as in certain, you know, simple terms. And then we added the awakenings to it, and it gave us a little depth. And now we're going to look at the introspective guide that Barbara and I have put together to describe more in detail what deconstruction is and what reconstruction is, and how they relate to the four awakenings, what goes on in order for that to occur on it. As Barbara said, this is what we call, Zazen introspection on it. And it describes the process of in six stages of deconstruction and six stages of reconstruction, from the first glimmer that we have had in our life where we understand that there is such a thing as a stream of enlightenment, and we can embody it fully on it. We are inherently enlightened, and we can make this realized in our daily life. And then we can take, and use the resolution sequence as a formulaic, a step-by-step way of giving us kind of a pattern, a structure, an organization by which we can know where we are in this process so we don't get lost. It's easy to do. We can check our progress along the lines with this, and we can make more accurately, we can make appropriate responses to what our situation actually is. And two other things. One, we'll have less of a tendency to stop, and a less of a tendency to be satisfied with a pleasurable circumstance. You know, to experience a transformation awakening is an exceedingly infatuating thing. So I can't tell you how many people, well, not a lot, but a few, get stuck in that spot. They get there, and then they it remains, their experience remains naive, and they lose the chance to really bring this out in a mature form on it. Westerners can use a roadmap. I think we've got a number of issues, you know, where we can get sidetracked. Barbara and I studied with a number of pioneering priests to group our people we've studied with, and not the exclusive, you know, with Suzuki and Katagiri, and I used to hear Colbin speak back in San Francisco in the old days, and other priests like Akiyama and Okamura, and both of the Narazaki priests and Narazaki brothers from Japan. And quite frankly, I don't think one of them really understands the self-hatred problem that we have as Westerners. And this thing is something that causes a lot of people grief, because we think that just experiencing the universal mind is going to solve all of our problems. And then we have the experience, and we still have our unstable, unhappy life, and we continue on a road that it isn't completely helping us. Anyway, I digress. The resolution sequence is hopefully a way that we can stay away from that problem. Now, you know, there's six stages in deconstruction and six stages in reconstruction. I'm gonna quickly go through all of them, and then we're gonna go on to another something that you can take home with you. Identification. Identification is the first step in the resolution sequence. And at this point, at best, we begin to hear about Buddha's teaching, and we get a little bit of something that we know that we can do something else with this. You know, the problem that we have manifests as afflictive emotions within us, the conditioned state, and they're painful, and we don't really understand what's going on, but our life can be upset greatly by this. So we move on, you know, maybe we hear, you know, something in a teaching or something, and we move on, and we move into the stage of separation. Usually separation, you know, is brought about by taking up the practice of Zazen on it. At this point, we can articulate what the conditioned state is, and Zazen gives us the ability to inquire into their function, you know, on it. The separation means that something has awakened in us and we can view the conditioned state. And this something that is awakened in us is the universal mind. It is, you know, the universal mind acting within the large personal events that and complexity that we are on it. And so this separation gives us an opportunity to view the conditioned state. And as we move into development, we can inquire into the nature of the conditioned state, how it functions, what triggers it, when is it most often, is it going to cause us problems? We watch our projection of the afflictive emotions into the world, causing us and others all sorts of grief on it. But also in development, we can recognize that there's something else, that this universal mind is not in conflict with a personal, but actually we begin to recognize the concordance of them. And doing so moves us into the maturation phase. The maturation phase is where we can recognize in total what the conditioned state is, not project the negative emotions, the afflictive emotions, into the world, causing other people grief, but we can hold them and we can cope with the issue. And this is the best that we can do at this point. We can have this and we can embrace all of these things, and we can go on in the world. Katagiri used to say, I don't know when your breakthrough will occur. I didn't like that too much. I wanted something more substantial. But the most thing that we can have substantial is we can hold and embrace that conditioned state and in that find a great deal of hope and satisfaction for going on. And out of that creative tension of holding and not projecting into the world all of the troubles, the transformation may occur sometime where the conditioned state is resolved, you know, and the psychophysical formation that was its basis is also not there. It is gone. It is somebody described it as a weight being removed. It's like a claw grip onto some portion of your body, and it's being released. And you have the physical and the mental afflictives, emotions regarding that are dissipated. And from that, a great deal of newness comes into the world on it. Prior to this, coping was the best that we could do. Now we have a chance to move on because we can recognize what this freedom of activity, what freedom of activity is possible. So we move on to reconstruction, and the next stage in the resolution sequence is proclamation, where we recognize, we say to ourselves, look at what has happened. Something new is here. What am I going to do about this on it? And so you form a plan on how you're going to do this. And the next thing that happens that goes along in the resolution sequence is that you must discern what has changed. And this is the discerning differences. Tongshan, Tozan Rokai, the founder of the Soto Zen, Tongshan's asked his teacher, I have leftover habits which are not yet exhausted. His teacher, Yunyan Yen, said, Honorable Reverend, now that you have taken up this matter, you must be careful and thoroughgoing. And he is speaking to what is right now. We have this sacred embryo as the product of all of our the work in deconstruction. And it can be years of stuff. It could be, of course, much shorter than that. And now we must do something with it. And the first thing we need to do is we need to discern the differences from what was before and what is now so we can know what to deal with on it. And in doing that, we avoid a naive understanding of things. And going on with that, after discerning the differences, we can go on to the next stage, which we call clarifying details, which is a place where we are open to the world and we allow the universal mind that so came into dominance in the transformation to penetrate into us even more, but not be apart from the personal aspects of ourselves. In other words, the outcome of this complementary activity of the universal and the personal, we find refinement of ourselves, of our intuition, of our emotions, of our thought, of our physical form, of everything that we are made out of. Dogen says, do not avoid anything. Take everything into your life on it. Do not try to push stuff out, but to embody this inclusive radical wholeness in all things. And this is the clarifying details where we can come to this refinement. And what comes out of it is, acceptance. And this acceptance Barbara referred to something a little sooner. This is not a just, okay, now I'm fine, go on. This is an active and dynamic contentment where there is activity and insight and appreciation and deep compassion and gratitude for your life on things. And only one thing just hanging, left over, that needs yet to be solved, and that's solved in relief and comfort, where the vestigial effects of the habit energies from the conditioned state are resolved, and we experience a change of behavior where in the 12th stage of the resolution sequence we call naturalness. So we can go into the world and just, you know, go on and not be doubting what we're doing all the time, and just being free from the afflictive emotions. I just want to say one more thing before we go on to looking at the shorthand card, and that is that we've discovered two things about conditioned states. One of them, I'm sorry to report, that it's just not one. It's just not two, but there are myriad conditioned states. We have a complexity. Human complexity is absolutely beyond our understanding. We have personal conditioned states that arise in our life, and we also have universal conditioned states that are based and rooted in antiquity. But the good part, I'm going to say about the conditioned states, is that they can be resolved. They are not only trouble for us, but they are the avenue to freedom, and they are a pathway to ever deepening enlightenment and realization. If you look at our symbol, you can see there's little arrowheads on that, and that indicates a dynamic activity, and it's never ending. Condition state, resolution, deconstruction, reconstruction, freedom, unencumbered activity, start again with another. Actually, most of us, if you get into this game of conditioned states and stuff like that, you're working on a number of them at one time.
Okay. Just continue. Okay.
So I've also handed out a little card. You know, this is my attempt to ameliorate my guilt over pounding you with all of this information. And we call this the shorthand summary of the resolution sequence. And here are the 12 different things that go on within this. First is articulating. We articulate the conditioned state. We observe it. We question or inquire into its nature. We embrace it. We are liberated from its afflictive problems. We lose the psychophysical formation. We assert our place in the new world of freedom. We note where we are. We open to the world. We have contentment and an opportunity for going on. And then a relief and comfort is we are what we've always wanted ourselves to be, why we struggle in Zazen. And the naturalness is where we share it, because enlightenment is never a one-sided game. It's awakening is always everyone. So I'm sorry to go on so long, but we have a couple of minutes just for commentary or questions.
I think some questions. Yes. Does anyone like to ask a question?
I just like to say it sounds like a really brilliant and vitally needed step and text and theory. And I hope it works.
Thank you, because what makes me nervous about, you know, kind of just putting it forward is this kind of deviates from the traditional instruction that we get, and it doesn't mean to diminish what the other, you know, instruction is. It's an adjunct to it, and in many ways, this work, and I think Dogen would agree, that the practice isn't just in the Zendo, you know, the meditative mind is to leave with us, and much of this work is how we can do the meditation outside of the Zendo, in observing how we're functioning in our life when we're not sitting still and can't create a problem except for ourselves.
Would this most of this information fall into the mindfulness basket?
Very much so. It's, you know, anything with Buddhist is, of course, mindful. And something to say about that?
If you want, it can be called that. You know, expanding awareness, mindful. Kind of thing.
I think the only thing, just like to add to it, it's directed, you know, in a particular way.
Did you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to ask. You were talking about how Coben and Suzuki and the teachers you met, you didn't think they had a grasp on the self-hatred that is prevalent in Western society. Could you say more about that, or where you think it comes from, or what it's born from?
Well, there's this famous meeting where there was a number of Buddhist teachers who were psychotherapists, like Jack Kornfield and others, with meeting with the Dalai Lama. And Dalai Lama asked, "What's your biggest problem in psychotherapy?" And they all said, "Self-hatred." Dealing with the people's low self-esteem and understanding of that. He didn't understand that.
Yeah.
And finally, you know, through the translator, he caught what it meant, and he burst into tears because he never realized, you know, the depth of Western psychology, you know, on that. You know, I lived with a Zen priest for 5 years, and he had lived in America for most of his life, and he didn't understand it. As many times as I tried to explain it to him, he didn't understand it.
I'm spelling of David Grove's last name.
G-R-O-V-E, Grove, like there's some, he's deceased now, but there are some things on the internet about his work.
Were there any triggers that you guys found in your studies that were easier to deconstruct than others? Like, maybe something that's triggered by speech or the positioning of the boss and the employee?
Oh, I'm sorry, would you state the beginning of your question again?
Just were there any, I guess, triggers that were easier to deconstruct than others?
Some issues are, the interesting thing is, in terms of doing this work, I think we've discovered that there seems to be an autonomous nature to what wants to be healed first. There's, and you find that by what's the problem. That's why I got to Gary asked that, what's the problem? And so in dealing with series of them, in the, each one that is resolved, you feel, oh, that was deep, I should have worked on that one first.
Because
but
it's more in the foreground, you mean?
Yes, right, because it just comes up more. But that doesn't come up until the previous one was resolved. There seems to be an autonomous nature to the information and what needs to be released first so that you can access a deeper and deeper one. So if you want to work with it, don't struggle by, you have to find the right one. There isn't any right one. If it's, you know, anger or insecurity, then you investigate it. It's really important, and the articulating part is to be able to frame the your statement of the problem in your words. And don't settle for the first one, but work with whatever the issue is. I'll work with the woman that's in this book in the back, an example of another way of working with the resolution sequence. And it took her a little while to figure out what she wanted to work on was trepidation. But until she named it trepidation, she, you know, she, but once she said trepidation, she knew that was it. That was the crux of it. The thing that David Grove says that, as a psychotherapist, was helpful for me is that the conditioned state holds the history of the experience that originated it. And there's ways of working with that so that unwinds. But using your language and, you know, if in regular conversation we can say, well, it really made me nervous, and you can say, well, why were you so anxious about that? And I'll know what you mean. But when we're working with a conditioned state, you find that one word because that word is going to take you to that, the origin of that. If you call it anxiety one time and trepidation another, or insecurity a third time, you're going to, each word has a lexicon of history in our literally in our biology. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, so pick something. And don't go for the deepest thing. You know? Just, you know what? In a way, have fun with it. Start with something. start with something light. Like, well, wouldn't it be nice if, you know, every time I did this, I didn't have to feel anxious about it. And then, where do you feel anxious? In your stomach, in your throat, in your chest, in your stomach. Kind of. And then just look at that. And then notice when you're anxious or when you have any negative feeling. How do you know you have that feeling? Where is it? So that's information for your life, beyond the fact that we don't want to be experiencing that. Who wants that? But it's there, isn't it? So
one of the things that is adjunct to this low self-esteem is that we mistrust our intuitive understanding, our intuitive knowledge. We, you know, all of the Zen teachers say that we are inherently enlightened. And yet, who among us, you know, really trusts that information? Who says, you know, oh, I'm inherently enlightened, you know, on it. And what does that mean? And one aspect of it is the whole resolution sequence is focused on guiding and taking seriously and using the intuitive understanding of our inherent enlightenment. It's right there all the time. And until we can get past that mistrust and doubt, well, then we can go on. What is Buddhist faith? Buddhist faith isn't belief. It's trust and confidence. Two elements.
There was a question.
Yes.
Thank you very much. It looks like you're describing a process that has a beginning and a sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes anger and other things can help foster that. But I, in a larger scale of maybe when a lot of people get angry, maybe they get these minor epiphanies that begin to spin off. And I'm just wondering if you could consider the 47% notion and maybe starting with a small A, getting the ball rolling.
Everybody has to do their own work.
Right.
Patience and understanding. I mean, some of the things that have been difficult for me in terms of dealing with other people who, my perspective of what I would like to see happen in the world, you know, is far from theirs, and it's painful, or when I become angry or frightened, you know, by what I see happening. The thing that helps me most is to try to frame it in, that is the form of that person's suffering. Then I can have some compassion for it. But if I just become frightened, you know, for a while, you know, the tone of the country is getting kind of strange and it feels kind of scary. And when I say, oh, that's scary, then I quiver and I don't have a lot of energy. And one day, I said to myself, I have to stop not saying scary. What it is dangerous. And so, but when I say that's really dangerous, I have some energy. So I don't know if that answers your question, you know, in terms of how to shift a cultural
or social.
Right. Something's happening, then it's not just here, it's all kind of all over the world. There is some, you know, movements and things. Well, we don't know, you know, where will this go? You know, we don't know. We can do our individual piece of it. But in terms of how to shift that, people, you know, we've traveled across the country. We can go into the littlest town. I mean, 700 people. There's a yoga studio. There's a Tai Chi center. There's, you know, so the other side is happening. I think it's just quieter. I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you.
You know, there was a time back in the late 60s when there was a tremendous bombing going on in Cambodia. This was at the San Francisco Zen Center. I know maybe some of you know Claude Dahlenberg. He was a longtime Zen practitioner there. And he got up and he was speaking for everybody in the room. There was quite a bit of people, 120 people there. And Suzuki was asked, you know, what are we to do about this bombing?
About the war.
About the war. And he said, find the roots of the war in yourself. So we're making the war. That's what he was saying. It's not something we want to hear. I didn't like that answer. I don't think anybody else wanted that answer either very much. But after many years of, you know, of reflecting on it, there is no other place to go.
There was another question. Gentlemen, did you have a question?
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of teachings, there's an emphasis on finding in your body where you're experiencing anxiety or anger, but I wonder if you could also talk some about finding that confidence and that trust in your body.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Thanks for breaking that up. The other part of working with this process is, you know, first we're going to do what we call the remedial work, you know, the things that are hampering us. And so those are the negative things, that those grab our attention. But if you do a number of those kinds of work, you can work on the other pieces, you know, in terms of what is joy, not just what is my suffering, you know, and that's when there's an interesting shift in the transformation. It's more in the sense of what I talked about, deepening the understanding. You're free of the obstructions that keep you trapped, you know, in limiting ways that you would like to be free from, so you could live and be the person you know yourself to be. When you work through a number of those and you work on the other aspects, then that becomes more of the universal information. First, we have to work on the personal side because that's the one that's obstructing the view of the universal. So if you do that work, more and more of the work, it becomes less painful, it becomes it becomes quicker, because you, from learning the process, you gain trust and confidence in your own ability to do it and the intuitive knowledge that comes from it. You know, I'd just like to say that, you know, when we're talking about transformation, and we're not talking about, you know, the big capital E, enlightenment, you know, everything. But even the Buddha, you know, he did not achieve his awakening in meditation. He stopped and he looked up and saw the morning star. That's when it occurred in his interaction with the world. So when we're referring to what's a transformational experience, it's either something that you connect with, you know, you've had it. When you had your aha, what was the trigger? And why was it that? Well, you don't know, but you're grateful that it was that. So it's either your interaction with something you hear or have read or have seen, or in meditation, and an insight that occurs in your zazen. John?
I'd like to go back to Jerry Seinfeld.
Thank you, because there weren't enough jokes in this presentation, and we apologize for that.
I can't help but remember when Seinfeld admitted that the entire show and everyone in it was about absolutely nothing.
Right. Doesn't he start the series talking about it? That's how he got his series. He and George talk about that.
Speaking of nothing, if we don't return from
it, you're going to lose the tensile.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.